Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Right, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg, and today I'm going to welcome Chris Jackson to the show. And hey, Chris, how's it going?
Good, thanks, Fred. How are you going?
All right, really well, and I'm excited. I'm glad to bring you on as a host. Hopefully, more than I don't scare you off in the first couple episodes we do, but make you a regular part of the sequence of Speaking of Reliability.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, you bring. You know, I've known you for what? I'm trying to think. It's been at least 5 years. 10 years, I think. Yeah. And you bring a unique background and perspective to reliability. I remember in the University of Maryland course you attended that I was teaching, you're memorable only in that you were argumentative. you made me work to bring out something useful for you in the course, but you were also, I think, one of the very few students that I couldn't find anything wrong in any of your homework or exams.
Oh, thanks, Rick.
So, yeah, you set the bar pretty high. The fellow students after you, some of them figured out who you were, so hopefully that wasn't too bad.
No, that's quite all right.
But yeah, no, I'm. I know that we could talk about all kinds of different stuff in all kinds of range of topics, and we're starting to brainstorm some ideas and stuff. For people that know Chris, that are in our audience, you know, let us know. Head over to reliability.fm and let us know what topics you'd like us to take on, or let us know what questions you have if you know them. If you don't know Chris, through these episodes, I'm sure that's going to come out really easily. But Chris, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and especially in our first episode, is right off your resume, essentially, is do you go by Dr. Jackson? Have you ever done that?
No. Formally, I do. If I on the CV or resume or perhaps a signature block, but it's never something I insist people refer to me as. That's for sure. So,
okay. We might not have any big debate here then. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, getting a PhD and versus not, and in respect to reliability. But before we jump into that, let's take a real quick break.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Minitab Software for their support of Apex Ridge Reliability and the Ascendo community. If you'd like to learn more about their statistical software packages, please go to ascendoreliability.com/go/Minitab.
Hey, so Chris, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but so what good is a PhD for a reliability engineer? I mean, what's the deal here?
Perhaps I could take it back one level. A PhD is obviously a postgraduate award issued by universities. And I think that to answer that question, you really need to understand how good that university is at connecting with the industry or what that university is trying to do. So the reason I say that is I think there is a growing divide between where universities are heading in the domain of reliability engineering versus, let's call it, commercially homegrown reliability engineers, as you put it. Mm-hmm. And every year, in my opinion, I think that gap gets bigger and bigger. So
you're talking about like the ivory tower academic? Universities are creating these, you know, they are really good at researching a topic and exploring ideas. But when it comes to, I think Ben Franklin said it best. He knew this really smart guy that could speak 7 languages, but he wrote a cow to work.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, perhaps not quite the same as what a sentiment as Ben Franklin, but I do believe that universities are still trying to chase those big, let's call it governmental style customers. They're big ideas they're trying to solve, and they do involve significant theoretical challenges. But perhaps the most important thing that any organization can do is to, for example, make sure its Formica is done well. I've actually recently been studying the reliability characteristics of satellites, and it's almost amazing that whenever you look at the guidelines and standards and things like that, they tend to focus on wear out failure mechanisms. That is, radiation damage, any failure mechanism that accumulates damage over time.
Right.
Problem with that is that satellites, when they fail, it's exclusively due to wear-in failure characteristics.
Well, they got to survive being manufactured and launched, and design mistakes right at the start or manufacturing mistakes. Those, yeah, like any product, right?
Correct. Yeah. But those and another form of failure are the only ones that drive satellite reliability. The other form is, especially for the small satellite industry, is the dead on arrival probability. So we know that, for example, the smaller nanosatellites, there's about a 20% chance based on industry data that that satellite will not function once it deploys.
That gets expensive even for small ones.
Absolutely. And then we have, for those that do survive, they have exclusively wear-in hazard rates, which means that manufacturing, like you said, Fred, but you look at all the standards and all the academic research and so on and so forth, it's physics of failure, highly complicated modeling of fatigue and radiation damage and things like that. But the data says, no, we need to focus on manufacturing. We need to focus on the less academically sexy stuff.
Well,
but
yeah,
that's not what we're doing.
I guess I'm not the sexy one then. As I started in an industry as a manufacturing engineer, and you've heard me say it, is that it's, you know, that perspective to the world is being a manufacturing engineer and trying to shepherd products and new products through a factory for the first time or on an ongoing basis taught me that it's always the design's fault. Not the designer's fault. It's the design's fault, you know. And I think I took a class at Stanford about design for manufacturing, and his premise was that the design should be so straightforward that you put all the random parts in a paper bag and shake it up and it self-assembles. And it should be designed well enough that that happens. Right. That way the manufacturing can't make it worse. We still figure out how to make it worse. We still add variability to it. But why, I mean, so the homegrown for me anyway was I understand manufacturing processes. I understand that robustness. I understand the early failures. If I grew up in an organization as a design engineer or a manufacturing engineer or whatever engineer, I would see all these dead on arrival stuff. I'd see the early life failures stuff. You know, And you're right. If I go to the textbooks, it's all about 20-year wear out or 15-year degradation of a capacitor. And like, it's not helping me here, guys.
No. So I think the real, perhaps not the real, but perhaps one of the biggest issues is that when you're talking about PhD or homegrown reliability engineers, is that the PhD reliability engineering type tends to focus on what he or she wants to focus on based on what they find academically interesting, whereas the homegrown reliability engineers tend to have a better understanding of what drives business. And so where I'm going with the satellite discussion was that we see a bunch of academic focus on things that the academics want to focus on versus the things that the data suggests we need to focus on in order to actually improve reliability.
Yeah.
So,
I think that the homegrown guys could also, and I've seen it where they focus on what they're familiar with.
That's true.
If they only know manufacturing variability, they may come in and create a reliability plan that just does process capability studies. It's not.
That's true. Exactly.
You know, that's the hammer they have, and that's what they're going to apply. I think that might be just a bias, whether you're a PhD or not, as you work on what you're interested in, right? And I think one of the challenges of managers is getting the talent that you have interested in solving the problems that are meaningful. Yet I think there's a separation. I've seen really, really good homegrown engineers, I'd say myself included, and you know, really, really good PhD reliability engineers that actually do that connection to the business. And I think that separates the good reliability engineers, the ones that recognize that they need to add value, they need to contribute to the organization in a meaningful way, versus being in an ivory tower and doing, you know, what you're academically interested in, or as a homegrown, what I'm capable of doing, what I'm comfortable doing with.
And yeah. So perhaps we should talk about failure modes of the reliability engineers themselves.
Yeah.
The academic reliability engineers, when they fail, it's primarily because they refuse to set foot outside of the ivory tower. And you're right, those homegrown reliability engineers, when they fail, it's because they focus on what they feel comfortable with, and not, which is the antithesis of continual improvement. And there's obviously good examples from each camp.
Now, going through the rigor of getting an academic degree. Now, I've heard that getting a PhD is not just so you can hyper-specialize on one particular area. It's kind of the pinnacle of, you know how to learn something, right? So why do some PhDs stay within their domain and don't continue to learn, whereas others just absorb knowledge and continue in it? They could qualify for PhDs every couple of years because of the ongoing work they're doing. What is that, a personality trait, or is that, are we stereotyping too much, saying that it's an ivory tower academic is only ones that have the PhDs?
No, look, there's certainly people who have PhDs out there who certainly set foot outside the ivory tower, so we know that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I know what you're talking about, and I think it is a personality issue, and you really, to an extent, you can stereotype, and to an extent, you can't. So you'll have a lot of people who do PhDs want to remain in the field of academia, and so that is a subset of the population.
And that's a choice, as looking at career options and career paths. If you want to be in the academic world, then a PhD is kind of a path, the venue to get there. And that makes sense. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But I'd argue that there tends to be less entrepreneurial thinking in the academic world. There's certainly lots of – I sense it's more of a – people should come talk to me because what I say is valuable in the academic world, whereas outside of that, there's not so much. It tends to be people are more vigorous in making the case. And I know that's a generalism that doesn't apply in all cases. But I do think there is a tendency for PhD reliability engineers to focus on what they want to focus on, when the bad ones, that is, or the those ones in the ivory tower.
Present company excluded, of course.
Correct, yeah. absolutely. But then because they've invested so much into that particular thing, that particular topic they've researched, that in a way that they're uniquely proud of it, and almost get devastated when the world does not sit up and take notice. And I can appreciate that, especially when you're talking about the younger people who've just got straight out of high school, do an undergraduate degree, decide to stay on to do a PhD. They just don't get that the world has not been waiting for them to solve that problem necessarily. And the problem they're solving is often orders of magnitude too complicated or too niche for it to have wide applicability. When I got my PhD, it didn't make me any smarter. How's that for it? I was already...
Oh, I tried. Come on, Chris. I tried.
No, sorry. I mean, I got a... Let's differentiate the master's degree and the PhD. So for your master's, let's call the master's degree the subjects you take, and the PhD, the dissertation or the thesis. I mean, certainly learned a lot from the subject, the coursework, but let's call it the master's element of a PhD.
Okay.
But the actual PhD, where you get a dissertation and you go and study a problem and spend, you know, a couple of years contributing to the state of the art. Again, that of itself does not make people smarter. I think that you've already got to that. You certainly learn about something new, but it's not, you're not necessarily developing that person anymore. That person is who they are at the start of the PhD, and they're going to use their research skills to add something new. So I hope that clarifies.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're coming. One of the ideas I thought, well, the PhD and doing the deep dive study and tending to want to stay in that field. I mean, if you're going into academia or you want to become the world renowned expert on XYZ topic, and you write a dissertation, you write a book, you go on the speaking tour, you know, there are examples of that, but it's kind of the rock star approach, I think, in the private sector, that you're the world renowned expert in, you know, dielectric materials for a particular capacitor. It's limiting. If the topic is in demand enough, like right now, lithium ion batteries are probably, if you're the world expert in that, you probably have a full-time job. But it's real hit or miss, isn't it? It's, if we all of a sudden move to a new chemistry, that PhD is going to be the world's rock star at that moment. That it doesn't necessarily mean that it makes a bad reliability engineer. If you're the expert in lithium ion battery technology, and that's, you can contribute a lot, not only to the industry, but to whatever organization you're working with as a reliability professional. What I find more often, though, is that reliability engineers and the reliability managers really have to be a jack of all trades, because the problem today is, it could be, hey, the satellite doesn't survive the vibration, the sound induced vibration, or, you know, to get into orbit. So it doesn't matter if it survives radiation for 30 years. You got to solve that problem before you have a product. And it's the tools and techniques of the research, of the problem solving, of engineering challenges, from my perspective, has always been very, very practical.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes a good reliability engineer, whether you're highly trained or not.
Yeah, and the reality is, with the academic space, is that, look, you tend to chase grants. You need the whole university culture, particularly engineering culture, is in academia, is you're chasing grants, you're chasing big contracts, you're chasing grand problems that need solutions. So you need departments of energy, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, governmental agencies are those sorts of customer. And what the biggest challenge for reliability performance in any organization is the management and the culture. If the management and the leadership just do not appreciate or do not get or do not want to get the importance of reliability, then you're just not going to have a reliable product at the end of the day. And so the biggest space shuttle, essentially, the program was shut down because of obviously two failures, but the root cause of those failures started back in the early 70s, when the discrepancy between what NASA wanted to do and what the then administration under Nixon was actually prepared to fund to do, the discrepancy was never resolved. And the phrase dominant flight space culture, trying to do too much with too little, those sentiments have echoed every single space shuttle review since the 1970s, and we now know why. So that's an example where just the culture was essentially the root cause of poor reliability in the space shuttle. And we look at Deepwater Horizon, we look at Fukushima. These weren't failure mechanisms which were hitherto unknown. It was leadership, management, organizational culture.
Yeah. It makes me wonder, though, on the SpaceX and Blue Horizon, I think, is another space company. They're trying to do commercial ventures into space, you know, and passenger rides into space. But I think it's more taking payloads up. Is there there's got to be PhDs there.
Oh, absolutely.
But
absolutely.
But yeah. I mean, is the culture, because it's driven on a profit thing and it doesn't have all the test pilots, but I find entrepreneurs and startups very much that test pilot kind of approach. Let's, you know, get it good enough and ship it. I don't think that goes away.
No.
That cultural piece. I think that's a whole separate topic for us to talk about, is the reliability culture of an organization and how that it affects it.
I think that one of the best things that, or the biggest things that these new startups have going for them, is that they essentially get to a clean slate. So a lot of, again, governmental agencies.
Well, as long as they don't hire a PhD that just wants to chase grants, I think we'll be in, they're probably better served. But that's, I think that's the main point, though, of this whole discussion, is that it's not your resume.
No.
To a large degree. I think having a PhD from a, and you mentioned from a good institution, if the institution is generating nothing but academics and creating teaching fellows, basically, to go continue the lineage and write books and papers and so on.
Yeah.
Versus, I know that University of Tennessee has a really good reliability program, but they produce asset management and maintenance reliability engineers. Mm-hmm. And they're very connected to a lot of different industry connections. Sort of like CALS at University of Maryland. They're kind of that bridge between the big money super grants, and because they have so many different industries or companies funding them, they get real life projects to work on. And so it gives them a bit of practicality, but it's, I still get the whiff of the ivory tower there every now and then.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with the University of Tennessee, but I am aware that they do have a more, let's call it operational focus, the asset management, the ongoing maintenance, which is useful, more useful than people give it credit for.
Well, it's a huge industry and huge business, and they generate very practical-minded folks coming out. Whereas, you know, and we'll leave some names unnamed, but if the resume is just, hey, look at all the papers I published out of my dissertation, it's like, well, have you ever been in a factory? Have you ever seen a product being developed? Have you ever played with a prototype?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the concern. And I think that if you want to be a well-rounded reliability engineer, if you want to get a master's or PhD, you just need to be aware of that. People are focused on, you know, practical real-world experience. There'd be many times where you walk into, no doubt you've done this too, Fred, you walk into an organization, within 10 minutes you know what they need to do, mm-hmm. but culturally you know that you need to have some few baby steps. You need to say, well, let's just do this small thing first, and then we get there, and then we'll talk. You just know that they're not ready to make that huge leap from where they are now to where they need to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that sort of understanding only comes with someone who's worked in that domain. I think where if you have a purely theoretical approach, you can say, well, this is where you need to go. Why aren't we going there now? It forgets the human element. It forgets, you know, you're talking to people who essentially, if you say that, you're almost insulting the work they've done. So all those, you know, emotional intelligence.
Change management. Deductions. Just the whole world of change management. It's not unique to reliability engineering at all. It's a big part of our world. I agree. You know, so it's... I think our conclusion, though, here, Chris, is that, you know, if you learn it homegrown, if you pick up the various skills and techniques, whether it's FMEA or HALT or ALT or all the acronym soup that we deal with,
yep.
There's lots of ways to learn that. And I have benefited tremendously from taking formal classes on reliability statistics, for example.
Absolutely.
And so if I would have dropped out of work and got a master's degree, I would have benefited from the rigor and doing the homework and understanding the different concepts in a greater depth so that I could solve more problems. Mm-hmm. But I think it's what makes a good reliability engineer is not so much the resume. And I think this is the part we're going to agree on. It's their approach to actually adding value to the organization.
And the key word's value. Yeah. Yeah. We concur.
And it's in context to what that organization needs and where they're at and so on. And there's good and bad organizations, and there's ways you can go about helping them appreciate and actually embrace getting a reliable product out on a consistent basis. And there's some you just got to walk away from and say, no, you're not ready for this yet.
That's right.
That happens.
You did rock bottom first.
Yeah. So would you say that, you know, getting your – well, I know that the class you took from me is stuck with you through the years, and it's been a great value.
Absolutely.
I should send you a bill for that.
But I thought I paid for that a while ago.
Yeah, that's true. But was getting the PhD, did that open any new doors for you, or was that worth the effort?
If we separate,
I guess the pause answers that question.
No, because it's conditional. If you do want a career in academia, if that's something you want to do, then you really need to have a PhD. Mm-hmm. I was in a situation where I was sort of offered to do the PhD. It wasn't something I was actively considering. In fact, doing a master's degree, I actually stumbled into that as well. I was living in Australia at the time, and I was asked to go across to the United States for a period of time to study, and the answer was yes. What am I studying? So I stumbled into it, but I really enjoyed it. I don't think the PhD has opened many doors outside of academia. And if you want to remain in industry outside of academia, I don't see the PhD as being overly significant unless you have a very specific topic in mind which relates to what it is you're trying to resolve in your relevant industry.
Well, like but the lithium-ion battery example, if that was your domain,
absolutely.
And then you're walking in with the perfect resume for that position.
Absolutely. So it's but most PhD students don't go to a university understanding what it is they will ultimately get their PhD, what their PhD topic will be either. So. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't regret doing it by any stretch. It made me think and you know, I've got new experiences. But I suppose for those people looking for a reliability engineer, you just need to judge a candidate based on all their skill sets. There's some great statistically minded people who haven't done a single course, and some great managers who have done a lot of academic stuff. You just need to be aware that different backgrounds can have different tendencies, I suppose.
That's right. You know, and I'm going to wrap this discussion up. We'll probably have to come back and talk about the certification process, like the CRE, Certified Reliability Engineer, or Professional Engineer. Does Australia use Chartered Engineer? Is that what the equivalent to PE would be?
Yeah, so Engineers Australia, which is the essentially, you know, the governing body for engineers, professional engineers in Australia, have what's called Chartered Professional Engineers, and it's broadly equivalent. There's no specific reliability engineering element to it. So I got mine in mechanical engineering, for example. But
you've got all these things. Jeez, you just...
I was forced or fell into each one of those, but here I am. they do have that, but it's like most things. You have to get to finish, pass a test, and you do professional development. I suppose at the very least, it demonstrates that you can organize your time, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we'll come back and talk about some of those things. And let's, Chris, is thanks so much for joining me on the Speaking of Reliability show, and I hope to do a bunch more episodes, and let's make it an ongoing thing. And then for listeners, Chris brings a different perspective from our other co-hosts. Each host on the show has their own background, experience, and motivations, and so on. Let us know, any of us, if you like talking, would like to sit down and talk with Kirk or myself or with Chris or with, you know, whoever. The way for you to join the conversation is to send us a comment or an email. You can find us at reliability.fm. It's the Reliability Engineering Podcast Network. And you can find, speaking of reliability, you can find plenty of places to leave suggestions or comments. Or you can find us on LinkedIn or on Ascendo Reliability. But we'd love to hear from you. We get messages every week now. The show has been growing very nicely, and we're getting more and more feedback. But it makes a difference as to what we talk about, and because it's really including you in the discussion that makes the show really as good as we hope to make it. And so we'd love to have you join us in this conversation by sending us your questions and ideas. So with that, Chris, that little bit of business out of the way, welcome to Speaking of Reliability again. I'm so glad you're here. And I'm going to keep pestering you about all these degrees and certificates and everything else you got. And, you know, part of it is I'm jealous. I haven't ever been that organized or fortunate to get all that stuff. But I think we agreed that it's not necessarily the credentials, it's what you do with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Chris. We'll talk to you again.
Well, thanks for having me on, Fred. Much appreciated.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.